security, mobile, cloud. Three mega trends that are reinventing the IT landscape, enabling a new world of work, and ultimately changing our everyday lives. Join host Caleb Barlow from IBM as we explore the latest news and insights for IT practitioners and security professionals.
This podcast is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Listen to other great tech podcasts at www.techpodcasts.com.
Want to listen to this show offline? You can find it on iTunes by searching for Caleb Barlow. While you are there, please rate the show so others can find it as well.
Hey, this is Caleb Barlow, and today is Monday, November 16th, 2015. Just a reminder, if you want to learn more about a lot of the things we'll be talking about here today, or any of the subjects we cover, you can typically find them on our blogging site, which is securityintelligence.com. Well, today I'm joined by Chris Poulin, who is one of my favorite people in the security realm. And he is a research strategist at the elite IBM X-Force threat research team. Welcome, Chris. How are you doing today?
Good. Well, glad to be here, Caleb. And by the way, likewise, you are one of my favorite people in the security world as well. So a little love fest going on.
Well, yeah. And to continue our little love fest, we're talking about IoT, which, you know, talking about IoT with you usually involves, you know, getting a couch, a warm cup of coffee, and an hour. So we're going to try to keep it to 20 minutes today. But, okay, so Chris, let's first start off by really defining the scope of IoT, because, I mean, people talk about industrial control systems, people talk about transportation, cars, boats, ships, airplanes, they're talking about fire alarms in your house. Where do you put your arms around what is IoT today and what's not?
Well, you know, technically, I think some of the analysts have defined it as any devices that talk to each other. Effectively, they don't need a user to control them. So, and I've heard other people, more of the technology laity, I suppose, who define it as any device at all. So your mobile device, your computer. But the reality is that if it has a human interface and you deal with it on a regular basis, like your mobile phone or your computer, laptop, desktop, then it's probably not part of the IoT. So it's really things, and you pointed it out, which is, you know, people think about smart home, things that control your thermostat, things that they're connected shower heads now, which prompts people to call it the Internet of Junk. So then there's connected cars, which is sort of the meeting between enterprise and consumers, all the way down to industrial control systems and large scale things like airplanes are now connected to the Internet. So it's effectively anything that's going to generate a bunch of data that has the ability to control itself and that will talk to other devices that also comprise the IoT.
So, you know, probably the best example of this in recent past, particularly in kind of crossing the threshold from a, you know, cyber-connected device into the physical realm, was the remote hack of Jeep Cherokee by Miller and Valisek. And, you know, you've been covering the space of connected cars for some time. I mean, what was your opinion on this? Was this as big a deal as I think it was?
Well, you know, it's interesting because their work was sort of a derivative in a way of University of Washington. There was a collaboration between University of Washington and University of California at San Diego back in 2010. And so there's this sort of history where they went through and they decided to find out how hard it was to hack a car if you actually had physical access to it. And they proved in 2010 that you could actually get through the entire car. You know, so if you could plug into the OBD2 port, or if you could, if you had physical access, you could wire into it. Any sort of security, any sort of physical separation between all the components were actually not that effective. You could bypass them. And just for the sake of clarity, there are three general parts to a car. You know, we call them the CAN bus, the controller area network. One of them controls the critical systems like the engine and the brakes and things that are obviously critical to the operation of the vehicle. Then there are the chassis components like windows and lights and things like that. Not as critical, although you would not want to drive around at night without your lights. And then there's the entertainment system. So they all try to keep those separate. And what they found is that if you had access to the entertainment system, you could get in fact jump over to the engine controls and the brake controls, and the same with the chassis controls, you could jump over there. So it was an interesting start to the research. And what really happened is that people said, yeah, well, if you have physical access to something, all bets are off.
Yeah, so I mean, how hard it is. It's not easy, but right. If you've got physical access, it's in the realm of possibilities.
Yeah, exactly. And so, interestingly, a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, Valasek and Miller, they took that work and they proved it out, and they ended up on the Today Show where they were, I think it was a Prius and a Ford Explorer, where they showed that they could, in fact, set the display on the instrument cluster and apply the brakes and turn the steering wheel and all that. But the reality is that most people said, well, yeah, there's a guy sitting in the back seat and there's a cable snaking across my console over the axle hump. And by the way, my dashboard is taken apart. So it's an interesting parlor trick, but it's not really, we're not really worried about it. So if you go back to 2011 to the University of Washington in California, San Diego, they encountered the same thing, you know, 5 years earlier. And so in 2011, they went through and they said, okay, how about remote access to it? What are all the ways we can get into a car? So across
the
telematics.
Yeah, and wasn't there some way somebody figured out like a way through the tire pressure sensors or something like that?
Yeah, well, that was one of them. It was interesting because you know that the telematics systems like OnStar and Uconnect and things like that give access to the vehicle. But you're right, the tire pressure monitor systems, which have been required since, I think, 92 or something like that, they basically run by radio frequency because it's hard to connect a hard wire from a spinning rim into the car. So there's a little receiver inside the car, and they found that if you got close enough to the car, you could actually break into the receiver for the tire pressure monitor sensors. So there was that, right? And there was all kinds of other things, the telematics units, like I said, the in-car Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, what else is out there? Keyless entry, which is radio frequency control. So there's a lot of ways you can get into a vehicle. So they proved two things, right, at the University of California, San Diego, and in Washington's, were that you could get into it remotely, number one, and number two, once you got in, all bets are off. So Valasek and Miller, you know, fast forward, they did the same thing this year. So they took their research and sort of mimicked what happened before, and they proved it all the way through. So I think finally, that's what was required for everyone, the public, the general public, the automakers, the security community, to take automotive security seriously, which is good, right? Because researchers, you'd rather have the researchers find that out and publish it than have the bad guys. So they're
well.
Sort of
I mean, I remember when they're going through their presentation, and there's this moment where you suddenly realize these guys have control over hundreds of thousands of cars, and I guess maybe we're just all naive in, you know, all these cars had an IP address when they're being driven around. And, you know, I guess we were all kind of thinking, well, yeah, OnStar can connect to it, but it doesn't have, like, a publicly available IP address. And, gee, you know, yeah, the entertainment bus needs to talk to the CAN bus so that, you know, it gets information like how fast the car is going so it knows what volume to set the radio. But you couldn't really jump on that. And boom, the next thing you know, here we are. Not only have they crossed over that chasm, but these cars have an IP address on the open internet.
I know. So there's two factors that come into play there, right? And I'm going to borrow a phrase that you're fond of, which is the art of the possible. And
yeah.
I'm going to pair it with one that I've been saying. I actually have had arguments with people about this. And my point is, and take it with a grain of salt, nothing is impossible. As soon as somebody says you can't do something, I immediately think, oh, yeah, we're going to go do that. And I think that's what Valasek and Miller were pretty much saying. And so it's true. It's funny because you can always predict things. I remember having an argument with somebody a long time ago, and it was back in the 90s, late 90s, and I was saying remote procedure calls are really dangerous on Windows. And particularly with something when Windows RPC was used, you would basically connect to it, and then it would assign random high ports. You know, so you really couldn't lock it down on a firewall and go, look, this is all dangerous for many reasons. RPC is bad, and random high ports is bad because you really have no predictability and blah, blah, blah. And the guy argued with me, and I gave it up because he was a client, and right, the client's always right. But, you know, 2-3 years later, we had one of our first RPC, Windows RPC vulnerabilities. And so the point, or exploits. And so the point was, and of course, I never went back to him and said, I told you so, you never do that. But the point is that if you think
but you
of
wanted
something,
to.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know me well enough. I'm an argumentative cuss. So, but, you know, if you envision something like that, somebody will figure out a way someday to make it happen. So the it's
so
always
how do
me.
We, how do we solve this, right? So, you know, you and I were talking earlier. I mean, can we be so bold as to say if it connects to the Internet, you've got to have a way to patch it and update it and fix it? I mean, are we really at that kind of extreme in all this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's true. I mean, and it's easy to say, by the way. So I agree completely.
It's totally easy to say. But, man, how do you have, like, a $3 sensor have a way to be updated over the wire?
Right. And so the devil's in the details. And, by the way, over-the-air updates or over-the-wire or however it is, you know, not everything's over-the-air. It's not the panacea, but it's certainly one of the many things that needs to be there. It's one of the fundamental security principles that need to be applied to these things. But so you think about, when can you patch a car, right? How do you, if it's driving along the highway at 7 miles an hour, you don't want to patch, you know, the electronic control unit that controls the brakes of the engine. You want to make sure that it's in a stable operational mode. And then how do you fall back, and how does it detect if there is some sort of operational failure in that? The second thing is, how do you check integrity in the first place, right? So how do you know that hasn't been tampered with over the air, that somebody hasn't installed some sort of they haven't already broken into the Wi-Fi module or the telematics module, and now they're tampering with the firmware before it gets to the engine or the brakes? Or and how do you know when you first start up the car in the first place that that the firmware is as it was designed and is the same firmware that was installed at the factory? So how do you deliver the vehicle securely? So there are a lot of considerations. So people say over-the-air updates a lot, but they don't necessarily understand the complexities that are involved.
Yeah, and I just think of, you know, as this stuff really starts to proliferate, you know, what's the infrastructure? What are the requirements if you're producing this stuff? So one of my best friends, I think I've told you this story before, he is a salesperson for programmable logic controllers. And he sells a lot of these things, right? And, you know, a PLC can be used to control anything from a pump or a valve to, you know, whatever you might have in an industrial plant. And he tells me this story about how he's got two different models. He's got one model that is more expensive, doesn't have as many features, and is a little clunky. And then he's got another model that's less expensive, works better, and, you know, ultimately has more features. And everybody buys the more expensive one. And I'm like, well, why is that? You know, he's baiting me. Because the Ethernet jacks are on the back. And, you know, as people go in and audit the industrial environment, they're less likely to realize that this logic controller is connected to the Internet. And that actually has become a selling feature, is that, you know, you can't as easily see that this thing is connected up. So, you know, what do we got to think about when we're getting to, you know, all this infrastructure, both on the consumer side and the vendor side? Where are we headed with this, Chris?
Yeah, infrastructure is an interesting and evolving component of the Internet of Things. You know, so when you think, I find that kind of amusing, though, by the way, that they put the Ethernet ports on the back and that satisfies the audit criteria. But, you know, because you go and you talk to these people who break into the IoT devices, and the first thing they do is disassemble them and look for the debug port on them, because they almost always have them. Just because they're hidden behind a cowling or some enclosure doesn't mean that they're not there and somebody's not going to find them. So, but I think that's a real good indication of where we are, which is that people don't know what to do with the Internet of Things. A lot of people don't quite understand what security means. They don't quite understand what the Internet of Things is, and it continually evolves. So it makes sense, right? Like, who would have thought that a thermostat would be the primary device that would connect houses to the Internet? you know, smart meters have been rolled out for a while, but now, of course, there's, you know, the smart thermostats, smart CO2 and smoke alarms and things like that. I would have thought it would be something a little bit more interesting, maybe appliances or whatever. And the refrigerator seems to have bombed in terms of a connected appliance. So it's evolving, and people just don't understand what it means and what the utility is. And so because it's in such flux, I think we sort of sit around as security people and just sort of scratch our heads and say, well, let's let this thing settle in before we actually figure out what to do with it, you know, except for specific things like cars, you know, so the researchers are actually doing that. So I think therein lies the problem, is that we can come up with all these ideas like over-the-air updates and secure coding practices and encryption. And there's a lot of things that we talk about. But the reality is that the manufacturers are not part of the security community, and they're not listening. So I think that's where our biggest disconnect is right now, is actually having influence over the makers. And by the way, right, we want the makers of hardware to write good software, and we don't even write good software in the software community. So
that's actually a really great point, right, is, you know, you've got this pressure all around, and this really takes things to the extreme in terms of code quality. So what's a consumer to do in the short term, right? Do you not buy the connected fridge? Do you get worried about a car that's got OnStar? I mean, I don't think that's the answer. But are there some practical expectations that people can take?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the Internet of the things, the devices, don't really have a lot of configuration controls for the consumer. So, you know, people ask me all the time, you know, what can consumer do? You know, and the reality is that you're kind of in the hands of the manufacturers. The things that you do have control of go back to infrastructure, which is, you know, if you've got, you know, for example, in my own home, I've got a few interesting devices, which I won't say publicly over the air because that's a little form of security by obscurity. But, you know, I keep them on a separate Wi-Fi network just so that they can't be entry points for, you know, the rest of my system, so somebody can't attack my desktop and banking. And that's actually, we're starting to see new protocols, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. It's 802.11an or something like that. That doesn't sound right to me, but something close to that, which is specifically for Internet of Things devices, which uses it's small bursty packets. So it's designed for low bandwidth, small packets, so that and long distance, and it's also at a lower frequency, so it can pass through walls and, you know, other solid devices more easily, because that's what IoT devices are. So, you know, that's not a security feature, but my point is that we're sort of transitioning between things that we understand as security people into protocols and devices and operating systems and all kinds of things that are new to us. So we are going to have to transition. And sort of by the same token, by the way, IT folks who have been used to dealing with servers and virtual machines, and now they've finally come to grips with cloud and mobile, are going to have to start to understand what HVAC systems are and why their escalators are attached to their IT network. I mean, I remember back in the 90s, we used to do a lot of pen tests, and you could almost always get into a network because the IT folks didn't manage the PBXs. And the installers always use the same password and connect them up to modem. So you just do some more dialing, find the modem, find the PBX, use the default password. And invariably, somebody would have wanted to print out the phone logs. And they're like, hey, let's go buy a printer. And they're like, no, we got a perfectly good IT network with tons of printers on it. Let's just cross-connect that PBX onto the IT network. And there you go.
Right.
You're in. So I think
at this even in my own house, to your earlier point. I mean, it used to be, you know, you go into, like, the log on your cable modem and, you know, it used to be, okay, there's a couple laptops, and then maybe there was a tablet came along. Now it's out of control. It's, you know, the security system, dozens of devices. There's lighting controllers, stereo, cable, every television's connected. There's even the little, like, you know, Amazon one-click ordering things for more dog food. I can't even keep track of all the devices on my own network. And then, and this was the one that really blew me away, I upgrade my my cable box, so my TV set-top controller, nothing to do with the Internet side of the equation. I plug in, and all of a sudden there's a new Wi-Fi network in my house. You know, because the cable company's broadcasting, you know, their open access out of my TV set-top box. So so, you know, I figure, all right, I got to go shut this thing off. If for nothing else, I don't want it eating up spectrum, right? It took me hours just to figure out how to get that turned off because, you know, you got to go log into some obscure website and, you know, deselect it and blah, blah, blah. But it's, to your point, it's utterly out of control. And I was just looking the other night. I mean, I've got a 24-port Ethernet router in my house. I'm like, I'm out of jacks. I got to go add more. I'm like, this is
you need more
utterly
wireless.
Ridiculous. Yeah, or move or more move more to wireless.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. You bring up a brilliant point, which is that a lot of these devices now want to enable access for a couple of reasons, right? And there's a story, and I haven't played with it, but I read it online about a camera that, you know, you take a picture and it'll connect automatically to your wireless access and upload the picture. So, you know, it's still a point and click, although why people buy those when you've had a phone that probably has better resolution is beyond me. But then again, I'm not a photographer, so no offense to anybody who's listening who is. So
but that's a great example, right? Just boom, it's done. I mean, yeah. I bought these. I've got these security cameras, you know, kind of like the classic nanny cam thing, right? And connecting it up was too easy. I mean, it worries me how easy it was. It makes its own secure tunnel out to who knows whose cloud, and the next thing you know, you can see your house over the internet. I'm like, all right, well, what else can come down this little data pipe that installed itself, basically? And I have no idea what ports or connections are going down that line.
Well, that's exactly right.
You know, so
and some of these things
so you start
have...
getting all these bridging opportunities, right?
Exactly. And some of these actually become – they're not just wireless clients, but they're also access points as well. Like that camera actually will act as an access point. So now you've got this new wireless access point that you weren't even aware of in your house. But it's kind of interesting because, you know, you talk to people and they say, well, one of the things that would be great for the Internet of Things is to have – instead of having your home and then it goes through a router and then it goes out to your Internet service provider into the cloud, blah, blah, you know, sort of a hierarchical and linear view of connectivity is to have all these devices be access points and peer to each other. And so now you've got this complete web of everything. So in other words, your thermostat is a wireless access point that connects to the camera, that connects to the shower head, that connects to the coffee pot, that connects to the smart meter. And that way, the whole world, no matter where you are, you're roaming around and you're connecting from wireless access point to wireless access point, which are ad hoc created by all these devices, which is kind of cool in a way, right? This big, ubiquitous web of stuff.
It is cool as long as there's not a man in the middle on any of those connections.
Yeah, it scares the hell out of me from a security perspective, but it's great from a functional perspective, and it's great for developing countries, right, who are actually trying to create infrastructure.
I mean, when was the last time you had to go get, like, a CD or DVD drive and plug it into your computer? I mean, everything just comes over the air now. I can't think of the last time I had to install software from some sort of physical medium, and anytime somebody hands me a USB stick now, I cringe. I'm like, well, just email it to me. Because then I at least know it's going through some sort of security check. Okay, so last question for you, Chris. I know it's bad.
I was just thinking that Box's icon should be Box.com should be a USB stick because they effectively have replaced those things. So anybody who gives it to me, I say to them, just put it up on Box or put it up on Google Docs or something. Just put it in the cloud. Get it away from me.
Yeah, exactly. Because then at least you've got a chance that either when it goes up there or when it's coming back down, the thing's being scanned in some way, shape, or form for at least known you know, malware or viruses or what have you. Hey, so last question for you. So with all this stuff going on, you know, we've talked about the challenges for consumers, the challenges for manufacturers. In the automotive example, are we seeing a change? Did this wake people up? Are they starting to think about doing things differently or addressing these problems differently?
Yeah, so that's a great question because here's the thing is that I've talked to a lot of automotive companies, right, auto manufacturers, and they actually get a bad rap because they're not really open about what they're doing behind the scenes. In fact, it's really hard for me to get face-to-face time with some of the designers. You know, a lot of the people that I talk to are sort of middle management, and they sort of hide the designs from the rest of the world. And that's not because they're not doing anything. They've been aware of this for a long time. But if you think about the inception, so the idea for a new car to actual production is anywhere between 3 to 7 years. It's somewhere in the 5 to 6 is average for a new car. And a lot of them borrow from old designs, right? So they don't just build one from scratch. In fact, Tesla is probably one of the first companies in the last 5-10 years who's had the luxury of being able to design something from scratch and build security in from the very foundation. So these guys are going through and they're retrofitting their cars for security. And they're sort of adopting a new model, which is they've used – their model has been this is an engineering feat, a mechanical engineering feat that's been designed and built in isolation. So now it's – even though there are tier one suppliers who are contributing to it, et cetera, but now it's coming under far more scrutiny. They're under huge legal constraints, right? They just can't go out and publish their designs for many reasons, but part of it's legal. And – so when I talk to these guys, they have been concerned for ever since at least 2007 is sort of when I – and I don't know exactly why, but that's sort of when I hear the cusp of when they really started to pay attention to cybersecurity of automobiles. So they've been working on the problem, but it takes a long time. So I think one of the messages that I try to get out there is that even though, unfortunately, the auto manufacturers get a little bit vilified by the press and sometimes by the public, they are working really hard to solve this problem, but it is not an easy problem to solve given, you know, the
You got to figure that car designs are probably done years before the car comes off the line. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I think of our development life cycles for software. I can't even imagine what must be involved in, you know, planning for the build of a car where you've got to bring together all those parts from all those different sources. You've got to build a line. You know, that's a whole other supply chain that's, you know, just probably requires an enormous amount of planning, probably, you know, many months or many years in advance.
It's true. And the life cycle of a vehicle, and a lot of these consumer devices are going to be a lot longer than we think of in terms of normal life cycles for software and for computers, which are usually 3 to 5 years. The vehicles.
Right.
I think I saw a stat that said it's 11.2 years is the life cycle of ownership of a vehicle. So, you know, as it transfers from the time it rolls off the assembly line to the time it's pressed into a big hunk of a box of metal is 11.2 years. So you have to support that thing throughout that entire lifespan. And in some cases, you know, upwards of 20 years or more. So not only
well,
that,
you know, I'm driving. I mean, I shouldn't admit this, but I mean, I'm driving around a 13-year-old car because it won't die. And, you know, can you imagine, though, what was the IT system I was using in 2002? I mean, you know, and we got to keep that up to date and running. I mean, I don't even think – I'm just trying to think, what was the laptop that I had in 2002? It was pretty scary.
Well, I'll tell you this. I don't know if you saw the news in the last couple of days, but and not to point fingers at anybody in particular, but there is a particular airport that was using Windows 3.1 as a meteorological control system up until now. In fact, it's probably still in production. So Windows 3.1, I don't even remember what that was.
Yeah, that's like pre-2000.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So.
Well, listen, Chris, thank you a ton. And if people would like to learn more about Chris, what he's thinking about, or read a variety of different articles on the connected car, Chris's opinions, and opinions of the researchers that work with Chris, you can check these out on securityintelligence.com. Thanks for joining us.
This content was provided for informational purposes only. The opinions and insights discussed are those of the presenter and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the IBM Corporation. Nothing contained in these materials or the products discussed is intended to, nor shall have the effect of, creating any warranties or representations from IBM or its suppliers, or altering the terms and conditions of any agreement you have with IBM. The information presented is not intended to imply that any actions taken by you will result in any specific result or benefit, and it should not be relied on in making a purchasing decision. IBM does not warrant that any systems, products, or services are immune from, or will make your enterprise immune from, the malicious or illegal contact of any party. All product plans, directions, and intent are subject to change or withdrawal without notice. References to IBM products, programs or services do not imply that they will be available in all countries in which IBM operates. IBM, the IBM logo, and other IBM products and services are trademarks of the International Business Machines Corporation in the United States, other countries, or both. Other company, product, or services named may be trademarks or service marks of others.